Well, we are slowly getting back to normal. I don't mean by that that I'm preaching, though it has been an abnormally good time, hasn't it, to have John Chapman with us. By the way, there's plenty of room right around here. It's been wonderful to have him, and I'm very sorry to have to replace him here on a Tuesday. I would love him to have gone on. He isn't, of course, disappearing from St. Helens. He'll be here till very nearly the end of July. But he has a number of other engagements. Today he's at Oak Hill Theological College. We hope waking up the students there in their midsummer slumber. No doubt they will not have heard anything quite like it before. And, of course, he'll be back here for many other activities and weekends in the days to come. And not least in the evangelistic weekend at Fairmile in the middle of July. You'll see the details of that on this sheet. If you have some friend who is not yet a Christian believer and who you'd like to bring to a weekend, then can I commend that weekend to you very specially? John Chapman will be speaking twice. It will be a very relaxed weekend. Nobody need feel at all frightened or embarrassed. It will be a time of relaxation and enjoyment amongst Christian people down at Fairmile. And these, we only have one a year, and it does prove, I think, a great blessing to those who want to introduce their friends to Christian fellowship and truth in this kind of way. Now, one or two other things. I'm glad to say I've only got back from away at the weekend, and I find the gift day total is 8,600. And that's a wonderful total for which we're very thankful to God and thankful to so many of you and to all our friends who've supported us in this way. The gift day is rather like the days of creation in Genesis. Nobody knows quite how long it is. And it goes on for quite a long time, so please don't feel that the opportunity has come to an end. If you haven't yet helped us to balance our books, we should be very glad if you'd find out about our gift day and help us. So, however, that's the total so far, £8,500, and we're very grateful for it. As I say, we're gradually getting back to normal. There is no lunch today, I'm afraid, because we had a special lunch yesterday, and our ladies' team were up for that. But we shall be having lunch here as normal next Tuesday. Well, now let's turn in our New Testaments to Luke chapter 18. And I'm going to be spending this month on a very important subject of the opening of men's eyes by Jesus Christ. Let me just explain that if I can. This sudden hot weather has given me hay fever, and therefore I'm rather sneezy. However, let me first of all start by explaining this great subject. The Bible is very unflattering about our fallen human nature. It says a number of things about us, and among those things it says that we are by nature blind to the things of God. Just as if a person can't tell the difference between red and yellow, we say that they're colorblind. The Bible, in a sense, says that we are God-blind, and that the ordinary person, that is, the person by nature, by ordinary birth, simply doesn't have any way of discerning the difference between religious truth. You often get that when people say, aren't all religions the same? You know, to say that shows that a person is absolutely blind. They are God-blind. They cannot see the difference between things that are so obviously different as Christ and others. Now, by contrast, the New Testament says that when we come into Christ, our minds are enlightened. We walk in the light and not in darkness. Last week I was in Norway, and during this time of the year, it's light nearly all the way through the night time. That's not really very pleasant if you're trying to get some sleep. But somebody who lives there was telling me how depressing it is in January and February when it is dark nearly all the way through January and February, nearly all the way through the day. And he said it's very depressing to live through the day, to get up, to go to work in dark, to go back in dark, but even in the middle of the day, to be largely in darkness or, at any rate, in twilight. I certainly can't imagine what that must be like. And yet that's the picture that the Bible gives of our lives without Christ. It says that we are in the darkness all the time. We don't know where we're going. We stumble around trying to find a point of compass so that we can make our way, but really not having the foggiest idea why we're in the world, why life is like this, where it comes from, where it's going to. And so this subject we're going to look at this month is a vitally important one because it shows part of the reason for the coming of Christ into the world. It shows the part of the work that he will do in the realm of a man's understanding and his mind, his thinking powers. Let me just emphasize that. There's a good deal said today about Christ and the human heart, and I'm thankful for that, because a Christ who could not touch our emotions would be a Christ who couldn't touch one of the most important parts of our lives. We often hear people talking about Christ and conscience, and again, he must have something to say about conscientious issues and the way to live. We hear people talking about Christ and our wills, how he wants to change our wills and the direction of life. But I think it's awfully important to say that God through Christ touches us not only in the heart and the will and the conscience, but that he touches us also in the mind. That is to say, the whole intellectual side of life is part of the reason for Christ coming into the world to redeem sinners. That by nature we're all mixed up, we don't see clearly, we don't understand God's purposes, we walk in darkness, and we very much need to know the way of light and truth. So what I'm going to do on these Tuesdays during June is to take four passages that have been pivotal to me in my own understanding. Actually, they're four very favorite passages, so I look forward to this month very much. Passages that talk about this particular side of the work of Christ in human life. And we're going to start today in a story that became very real to me early this year, Luke chapter 18, verse 35, the story of the blind beggar. Now, I imagine there were many such in his life, just as there were many in our own country until recently. Since I've been looking at this story and preaching on it for a number of weeks in various places, I keep finding pubs all littered around London called the Blind Beggar. Wherever I go off by car to preach on this story, I pass Mr. Inn Coop or Mr. Watner's Blind Beggar. There's one just along the road in Whitechapel. I take it that that goes back to the day when along Whitechapel, not so very long ago, you would have seen many a blind beggar walking along the street. So this is a very familiar thing in a society which is not as developed as we are today. And this blind beggar is sitting by the roadside, and of course he's begging. Now, I tell you how I got interested in this story, if I may. I was on holiday in February this year, and during my holiday I did a certain amount of preaching, but there came one Sunday when I had no preaching to do, and it really was a holiday. And as I got up that morning, I thought to myself, well, I mustn't be entirely slack. I will preach a sermon to myself. So I opened the Gospel Epistle and Collect for that particular Sunday, and I read through them, and I read in particular the Gospel, and I thought, I'll preach myself a sermon from this story. However, when I set about preparing the sermon, I was a little depressed, because the story is such a familiar one. I felt, as so many of us do when we reach this familiar territory, well, I know all this. And I thought to myself, if I can't be a bit more interesting on this subject than I am at the moment, I shall certainly go to sleep hearing myself preach this sermon to myself. So I had to get to work on it. And I began by asking myself the question, what does Luke, who is one of my favorite New Testament authors, want to teach the Christian church and indeed the whole world through the story? Don't forget, incidentally, that the Gospels are written after many of the epistles. They're written at the end of the New Testament era, when people realize that they're going to die and must write down before they die the stories that they have preached everywhere and that have been the basis for the Christian faith. So Luke writes down this chapter with a very definite theological or teaching intention. It's not just higgledy-piggledy as it happened chronologically. It's all put very carefully, as you'll see if you read this 18th chapter. And the first question I ask myself is this. Is Luke telling me that the mission of Christ into the world today is to cure the sick? Now, that's a controversial issue in some ways. And it's quite clear that Jesus did cure the sick, and that he gave his 12 apostles a commission to cure the sick, and that he gave the 70 disciples a commission to cure the sick. The trouble is that when he comes to the disciples at the end of his time on earth, he does not give them a commission to cure the sick, in contrast to the 12. The silence of the New Testament is sometimes important. He simply says to them, go into all the world and preach the gospel, making disciples. And it certainly seems over 1900 or 2000 years that by and large, the Christians have not been free from ailments and afflictions. And though it has been true that God in his mercy has sometimes healed the sick, especially when the gospel has come to the borders of paganism and has been preached for the first time in animistic and pagan societies, by and large, Christians have their ordinary share of sickness, just as I've got my hay fever this morning. Indeed, we may put this very simply, as I haven't time to deal with this in depth, by saying that some of the greatest Christians that the Christian church has ever known have in fact been blind all their lives. I think of one or two straight away. It would therefore be a very curious fact if these great Christian leaders that the church has known, who were blind throughout their lives, had lacked something in faith so that God could not cure them. It's more obvious and more easy and more rational to say that it was not God's intention to cure them of their blindness physically. Now, my thoughts have gone along these lines that early Sunday morning as I was preparing the sermon, hoping that I should have something interesting to say to myself, when I looked, as one so seldom does, I think, at the context of the story. One of the things, incidentally, that I aim to do here on Tuesdays, week by week and month by month and indeed year by year, is to look at these great sayings in their context. You only become a Jehovah's Witness or someone who is cranky and off-center if you take sentences out of their context. And if you look at the context, I saw that the Gospel of the day started at verse 31, which is where our reader started today. It started with Jesus talking to his disciples, telling them what was to happen in Jerusalem when he died. And then in verse 34, Luke makes a very significant remark, and he makes it three times. I don't know if you enjoy Lewis Carroll. I love him. One of my favorite characters in Lewis Carroll is the bellman. And you remember that the bellman used excitedly to tingle his bell. And then he used to say things over and over again and say, "What I tell you three times is true." Now, if you've ever taught an elementary school class, you will know that you have to tell them things three times, if not 300 times. If you have children at home, you may have discovered the same thing. And what Luke is saying here is that Jesus had told them over and over and over again what was to happen, but, verse 34, they understood none of these things. This saying was hid from them, and they did not grasp what was said. Well, you couldn't make it plainer than that, could you? In the slang of today, they hadn't a clue. They didn't know what he was talking about. Here was their triumphant Lord. Nothing was able to stand in his way. He says when he gets to Jerusalem, where they hope he will be crowned, he's going to be spat upon, shamefully treated and crucified. They simply did not see it. I got thus far in my study, and I felt I was really beginning to discover something important as to how and why Jesus told this Luke tells this story. I realized that Luke was telling us that if we cannot understand the things of God, there is only one thing to do, and that's to be like the blind beggar and to go to Jesus and say, "Please give me my sight and help me to understand." I didn't have any commentaries with me or any learned tomes to help me to see if I was on the right road. All I had was a concordance, and so I looked that up. And I was most interested to see that Luke is fascinated by the idea of sight, blindness, eyesight, and so on. It made me wonder whether his own particular expertise in doctrine was that doctoring was that of eye disease, which would be very likely, of course, in that part of the world. Now, if you've got Luke open, I'd like you just to see this for a moment. Turn back to Luke chapter 2, verse 29. Right at the beginning of his gospel, he sets the scene of the infant Jesus being brought to the temple to be dedicated, and there is this godly man, Simeon, who has been praying so hard that God would show him the truth, the Messiah, and what it all means, what all these prophecies mean. And suddenly the little family party comes in, and Simeon knows that this is the moment of truth. And he takes the child into his arms, and he thanks God, and he says, "Lord, now I can die in peace." Verse 30, "Mine eyes have seen thy salvation." Notice not just this child, but he sees deeper than the child. He gets insight. He says, "I understand that this is your salvation." And then he goes even deeper than that, "which thou hast prepared in the presence of all peoples, a light for revelation to the Gentiles." Now, isn't that remarkable? Thank you for showing me what this child means. And I realize that it's not just for me, but this light is going to shine throughout the whole wide world. It's for the Gentiles. An unthinkable thing for a Jew to say at that stage. It was many, many years before they accepted that. Well, now, are you excited by that? You, if you're a member of the Church of England like myself, can perhaps remember the Nunc Dimittis, for that is what these words are, sung on a drowsy summer evening in a village church in the evening. After the second lesson is read, the choir get up and a note is struck, and we sing through, "Lord, let us now thy servant depart in peace." As there we were saying something really very dull and ordinary. I sometimes wish we could get a bit more excited. A friend of mine went to a youth meeting which was largely Pentecostal the other day, and he was unwise enough to start the meeting by saying, "Isn't God great?" Pandemonium erupted. He was even more unwise then to go on by saying, "Isn't it marvelous to be a Christian?" Absolute bedlam broke out. People were clapping and waving their arms and embracing one another and so on. Now, I am not going to suggest that the Anglican Church necessarily goes in for that after the Nunc Dimittis, or rather in lieu of the Nunc Dimittis. But I must say it would be very nice, after the second lesson has been read sometimes and we hear the wonderful story of our salvation, if we could show a little bit more enthusiasm at the light that has been given to us. Or perhaps the light hasn't been given to you, and that's why you're not enthusiastic. Because when your eyes have been opened, you do want to shout for joy. And if you don't want to shout for joy, as Jesus said, the very stones ought to cry out. To be enlightened, to be able to say, as Simeon does, "I see," is one of the greatest thrills and privileges of life. That actually is what our Tuesday service is about. And thank God, many, many, many people down the years have gone out of St. Helens, or later on, have come to realize and to see what it's all about. Turn to the middle of the Gospel, Luke 19, verse 41. Again, this is unique to Luke. Each of these passages I'm turning up is unique to Luke. Here is Jesus drawing near to Jerusalem and looking down on the city at the end of his ministry. And he weeps over it, a very dramatic little passage. And through his tears he says, "Would that even today you knew the things that make for peace, but now they are hid from your eyes." And then he describes in terrible language the day that is to come, the day of thunder and blood and destruction and terror and disaster. And it's all going to come because, he says at the end of verse 44, "you did not know the time of your visitation." Now that's very dramatic, really, isn't it? Here is the capital city of the people of God. The prophets have spoken in Jerusalem and around Jerusalem for many centuries. They pointed to the time that God would come, that God would speak. And now for 3 years, the truth has been proclaimed in Jerusalem and in Galilee in a way that the truth had never been proclaimed before and will never be proclaimed again. The light had shone like the light of the midday sun. Jesus had been seen, and yet the average person walking about his business in Jerusalem hadn't the foggiest idea that anything had happened. They did not know the time of their visitation. I think this just reminds us that we would have been the same, that when God speaks, there's no ballyhoo and PRAs and neon lights and bells ringing. When God speaks, it's just a simple word to our conscience, and it's easy to miss it. You can have the Son of God to live 3 years in London, preaching like that, and we could have the Son of God, let me say this not irreverently, in the pulpit of St. Helens for 3 years, and at the end of it, the vast majority of people in Lloyd's and the Stock Exchange wouldn't have any knowledge. Do you not find that frightening? I find that frightening. We had a lunch for senior businessmen yesterday, and John Chapman gave a talk in the Leather Sellers Hall. It was an exceptionally clear talk. But talking to one or two people afterwards, although I know some did begin to see for the first time in their lives, I was sad at the way that some people were completely blind. Indeed, some people didn't realize what an important thing was happening. There were one or two men at the lunch yesterday for whom this was the only opportunity that they're going to get, possibly, as far as we know. That was the day that God in his providence chose to speak to them. And they went listening. That's pretty terrifying, isn't it? Turn to the end of Luke's gospel. He goes on with this theme, another passage that is unique to Luke. Luke chapter 24. Christ has died and the disciples are absolutely cast down because they do not understand. And two of them are walking back to their home in Emmaus, 7 miles from Jerusalem, and I should think it was 7 of the longest miles imaginable as they started out. How could they drag their one foot after another when all their hopes in Jesus had been utterly crushed? And in that moment, somebody draws near to them who they don't know. And Luke, with his usual interest in eyes, says, verse 16, their eyes were kept from recognizing him. However, Luke is really interested in not in their physical eyesight, but in the eyes of their understanding. And he tells us that they begin to converse, and these disciples say they haven't understood what has happened, and that Jesus, for that's who the stranger is, rebukes them, and says, "Why, you're very slow of heart to believe," verse 27, and then gives them an exposition of Moses and the prophets, verse 27, and interprets in them all the scriptures concerning himself. Now, I think if I could choose of the days of Jesus, one of them to be present, well, I don't say this would come top, but it would come very near the top. I would like to have been a fourth member of that conversation and to have walked along and to have heard the most marvelous exposition of the Bible ever given, as the Old Testament was unraveled before their eyes, and they saw that without the coming of Jesus as Messiah, the Old Testament is a dead book, which is why, incidentally, if Jesus is not your Savior and Lord, the Old Testament is a dead book to you. Well, the evening draws on. I bet they got home far too quickly, don't you? That time, there are some times when we get home far too quickly, when the journey has been so good we wanted to go on. However, they're back home, and they ask him to come in, and he comes in and sits down at table. And the host is just about to take a loaf of bread and to lift up his eyes to God and say grace, when Jesus takes the loaf out of his hand and looks up to eyes heaven and says grace. It is a startling enough thing to do. If you asked me to your home, you wouldn't expect me to do that, would you? And they look up startled, and they suddenly recognize that it's Jesus, and he vanishes out of their sight. Their eyes were open, says Luke, and they recognized him. Isn't that beautiful? You see what Luke, the writer, is telling the church about its job in the world? It's saying the way in which Jesus makes himself known to men is through the ministry of the Bible, the exposition of the Word, and the ministry of the sacrament, which covers, of course, not just the service itself, but the fellowship of God's people eating with one another, loving one another, meeting one another in fellowship together. And as the Word is explained and the Christians meet together and love one another, through that ministry, people's eyes will be opened. Now, I've only 2 minutes left. Let's turn back to Luke 18. How are your eyes going to be open? Well, it's said quite plainly, and I want to emphasize how simple it is. You see, this young or old beggar had to yell out, Jesus, have mercy on me, because the crowd weren't very enthusiastic on this. They probably looked on him rather as I look on some of the people who come to the front door St. Helens asking for money. I'm pretty sure they're rogues and that they're out for the wrong thing. And so the crowd perhaps can be forgiven for rebuking him and telling him to shut up. But he cried out all the more, please help me. Someone was talking to me yesterday, and we were talking about why people are reluctant to accept invitations to a lunch where a Christian talk is going to be given. And the friend said to me, well, you see, I think they're frightened of you enthusiastic beavers at St. Helens buttonholing them. Well, yeah, I guess Christians can get a bit too enthusiastic and start buttonholing everybody. But I want to say this morning that the world is not going to be won for Christ by Christians buttonholing their friends, for this reason, that people are very quickly frightened by that if they have no sense of need. But nobody minds buttonholing if they've got a real sense of need, you see. If Jesus had walked over to Bartimaeus and said, I want to buttonhole you, Bartimaeus. I want to get you and talk to you. Do you think he'd have run away if Jesus said, I want to give you your sight? Nobody minds being buttonholed if they've got a real need, and they know that the man who talks to them can meet it. That's the point of the story at the beginning of Luke 18. You see, the whole chapter is on that, of the widow who wants to get justice from the judge and can't get it. So she has to go and wait in his waiting room and stand outside his front door and keep ringing him up, trying to get justice. Do you suppose that widow would have minded if the judge had buttonholed her one day and said, I want to give you justice, show me your file, show me your papers, and I'll deal with it first thing this morning? Now, when people say to me, I'm rather frightened of those buttonholing me, I'm afraid it depresses me exceedingly. It just shows how blind and far away people are. Because one of the signs that God is moving again is that you don't have to wait for the Christians to get enthusiastic to tell people even. You start to find people sitting by the roadside in Lloyd's or the Stock Exchange or wherever it may be and beginning to cry out, Lord, please help me. Where can I find somebody to tell me? And when their friends say, I shouldn't get in with that, Lord, don't be too enthusiastic, be moderate in all things, including your religion, and all these other rather dampening phrases at which Englishmen are particularly skillful, the fellow doesn't stop. He says, but I must know, and I'm going to find out. No one will ever see anything, of course, concerning God unless they have that kind of determination. Let's pray. But he cried out all the more, saying, Son of David, have mercy upon me. Grant that there may be some who are sufficiently honest, Heavenly Father, and sufficiently courageous, and sufficiently in earnest to cry out all the more, and to discover that in thy Son Jesus Christ there is knowledge and understanding to be found. And we thank thee for that, in his name. Amen.